try to realize I'm the only one who can change myself. And I might try to close my eyes, wait to see if someone comes to help. And I might know where to go.
This is Jason Horsley, and it is April the 12th, 2024. It's 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I'm in Galicia, Spain, and by the River Minho Reservoir. And the sun, it must be about 25 degrees. Let's float away from this earthly Joe by Norman C. Habel and The Wondering Who by Gilad Atzmon, if I pronounced that correctly. And I'm going to see if I can have some thoughts, articulate some thoughts. A lot has been happening, of course, a lot is always happening in existence, if you just pay attention. I don't mean just phenomena, of course, there's an infinite array of phenomena happening, even as I speak, an infinitesimal amount of which I can actually consciously notice, think about, or talk about, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about uncovering aspects of my own psyche, whatever that is, soul, even less easy to define or identify or locate through the normal channels. I read a quote today in The Wondering Who, I believe it was, that exploring, for the artist to explore the self is to explore the world, something like that. And of course that's what I've been doing for the last 40 years or so, since I started writing and speaking publicly. And one of the things I'm aware of today is that I have a tendency to use the opportunity to speak publicly, to air my thoughts, dirty laundry included, as a safety valve, or a release valve, as a way to reduce the pressure that I'm under psychologically, emotionally, energetically, whatever else, when things are going difficult for me. I tend to talk about it, announce it, broadcast it, expostulate on it, expose it, and so on and so forth. I've written books, essays, podcasts, airing all of this stuff, and I don't really want to do that now, and perhaps not anymore at all. I just feel it's, I think it's a, it's a method or a habit that I'd like to break over time. Which doesn't mean that I won't talk about myself or what's going on. It's just that the reasons have to be subtly or significantly different for doing so. So what's on my mind currently then is the question of individuality versus collective existence. Individualism, collectivism, it seems to me that this is the most profound dichotomy that there is for a human being, because good and evil, man and woman, day and night, yin and yang. These are things that exist within us that they're quite abstract, well, day and night isn't, but the other ones are. And although we might struggle between, say, masculinity and femininity within our consciousness and our behaviour, and between good and evil, in terms of what's right and what's wrong for us, truth and falsehood would be another one, that's perhaps closer to practical and experiential. They're very general, very broad. And, ouch. Oh, I just got bit on the butthole by something. Like an ant. Whereas individuality and collectivism, well, anyway, that's what I've been thinking about. I'm thinking about how an identity, we tend to think of identity as to do with individuality, and that we're, in terms of we're seeking to find, uncover, express, define, assert, validate a sense of identity. That seems to be an individual, individualistic drive. But if one just thinks about it just for a moment or two, then one has to recognize that identity can't really have any meaning with, unless it relates to group identity. Because identity is to do with what we identify with. And if there aren't others with similar traits to those which we are identifying with, then there's nothing to identify with. I can't identify as water, for example. It doesn't make any sense. Even the transgender phenomenon, men identifying as women, it's still a collective identity, even if it's make-believe. Even to make any sense as make-believe, you don't have trans elementals as yet. People, humans, who are going around saying that they're water or they're fire, because it's just too ridiculous. The day may come, but that doesn't change the point I'm trying to make, that even when you want to start to fabricate an identity through sheer will and fantasy, you still need a group to identify with. This does pertain directly to the Jewish question, which is the this underlying thread of everything I seem to be thinking and talking and writing about these days. It's sort of in there, if only on the periphery of things. And I think that the reason, the deeper reason, that have nothing to do with political or even religious questions, unless we say religious in the deepest sense, has to do with this, is that the Jewish identity, as Gilad Atzmon writes about, is itself is a signifier, exemplifier of the way that identity itself is forged through a combination of group identification and negative identification, which is to say tribal consciousness combined with opposition. Like a tribe exists in opposition to other tribes and other forces that threaten its livelihood, and that to a degree, to a very large degree, that's what defines that tribe and thereby that tribal identity. So identity, if we look at the Jewish question as a sort of magnification of something that's universal, then identity is a combination of collective identification with negative identification. What you're not, what you hate, what you're opposed to. And this is the problem with Jewishness, but it's also the problem with humanness insofar as we identify, even with being human, you might say. If we take it all the way to its logical and inescapable limits, then any form of identification really is a problem, is a negative and collective identity, and therefore is a false limitation. I mean, I can acknowledge that I'm human, I would say, without identifying with being human. Just as I can acknowledge that I'm a man, or that I'm white, or that I'm English, or that I love movies, or that I'm a writer, or I'm this, that, and the other. All of these things I can acknowledge, but I don't have to identify with them, their characteristics and qualities. So in a similar way, it's just less easy to talk about being human is also something that we're not limited by. Like a large proportion of qualities that we have or partake of can be included under the designation of human, but not all of them. Consciousness, for example, is not limited to a human form, and so on. Love, fear, hate, movement, heat, colour, tone, sound, etc. There's a whole host of qualities that are not defined by humanness, and they don't define humanness either. So we do exist on this much, much, much larger spectrum than merely the human. And that's, I mean, I'm going all the way out to the limits, to the outer limits, really, of the argument that I'm formulating here. Out of very little, really. I mean, I'm trying to not be abstract, because being abstract I don't think is necessarily an asset, but to not be too specific, to not get caught up in the specifics of what's going on for me now and how and why I'm talking about what I'm talking about. I'm trying to just see what insights emerge directly, but at the same time kind of broadly, without seeing the clear chain of thoughts or associations that lead to the insights from the stuff that's going on in my life. So what the stuff that's going on in my life, okay, I'll get to that now so that we can balance out the stuff I've just said with the nitty-gritty and the concrete, so that it is grounded, it is anchored in something. So reading Gilad Asman's The Wandering Who, reading the Book of Job by Norman C. Hable, looking at the footage from the Light of Dead Stars film, the short version, The Facts of Life, that I shot or oversaw the shooting of as the writer-producer in London. I got bitten again by an ant in my butthole. Why do they keep going for my butthole, I wonder? Watching the footage, yeah. Well, having that experience of seeing the correlation and the gulf between the vision that I tried to encapsulate in a written script and its realization, or partial realization, as a film, as footage anyway, it hasn't been edited yet. So that's going on. And then at the homestead, as I tweeted yesterday, two of our chickens were killed by a fox 2 days ago. It was very sad and wrenching to find them dead and dying. One was dead, the other was dying. Necks broken, bitten but not mauled. And I was particularly sad for my wife, because she's very close to the chickens. She loved them. But she took it well once she believed me. At first she didn't believe me when I told her what had happened. So I guess she went into shock initially, but then she adapted very quickly, and I said, well, we should clean them up and eat them, and she was a bit surprised, but obviously saw the logic, and that's what we did. She plucked them, and I did my first dismembering and gutting of two chickens, and then we boiled one, and I roasted the other. Meat pie. This is the boiled one. It's going to be a meat pie today, probably, and Rusty. We had roasted yesterday, roast Rusty. And I did see the fox. I was there too late, obviously, to save the chickens, but I was there in time to chase the fox off and thereby save the chickens for us, the bodies, the corpses, the meat. And although I feel sad about the chickens, of course, this is life on the farm, and if we were going to raise chickens to eat, then there'd be no time for such sentimentality. And as it happened, this seemed to be a nudge from the fox, and the forces behind the fox of existence and nature towards that end of killing our own meat. Because now that I've done it, I didn't kill the chickens, the fox did that for us, but I've seen it done, and I'm pretty sure I can do that. And I mean, I was never too concerned about having to kill a chicken. It was always the cleaning and stuff that I always thought was going to be really hard, but it turns out it's actually not that hard. The hardest part is pulling the guts out with your hand, and that's just something you get used to with practice. So I feel that that was a kind of graduation brought about spontaneously. And, well, no end really. That's that. That's that little portion of what's going on. I won't go into the details of what we're working on the land, but suffice to say that I'm back at it after getting back from London for the film, and back at the Substack, and I don't have a podcast for tomorrow. That's why I'm doing this. I'm hoping that this will pass for a podcast, even though I'm aware it's very tricky to do these solo things, because I don't have a clear sense or feeling, a felt sense of why I'm speaking, or who I'm speaking to, or for, or what it is that needs to be said. It's just not clear, and I don't mean cognitively, I mean it's not viscerally clear. I can't feel so easily like what the body wants to express. I think this is the first time I've done or attempted to do this by the water in the sun, so it's maximum relaxation potentially, and I would say that that's the most essential thing really in terms of any sort of communication that we attempt, is that, or anything at all actually, is that we are as relaxed as we can be, so that the body is a suitable instrument, suitably attuned as an instrument to the vibrations, if I can use that word, of the soul, what is beyond the physical and beyond human, indeed, even relaxation would appear to be the key. So I'm going to use that as a segue to this other broad subject that I want to talk about, which has to do with expression. Now, for 15 weeks, I've been writing about the Holocaust and the Jew question, on and off. I mean, I've been circling around it, I've been digressing, I've been covering various different subjects from different angles, but consistently, it has also touched upon or directly delved into the question of whether the Holocaust happened, whether the official narrative about the Holocaust, which would say is the planned extermination using gas chambers of 6 million Jews during World War II, whether that is a true story or whether it's a fabrication. And then the broader question, the due question of, well, what's going on there? I'm not even going to try and sum it up because it would take too long, but the Jewish question, what it means to be Jewish and what the influences of Jewishness in the world and so on. It's very hard to talk about, and this is exactly what I wanted to talk about, is why it's so hard to talk about these things. Now, the Holocaust, it's pretty clear why it's hard to talk about, because there are actual laws against talking about it, as I've talked about. The Jewish question, likewise, there are laws against anti-Semitism, and as Atman points out, you can only generalize about Jews if it's positive. If you generalize about Jews in a way that isn't clearly positive, it is anti-Semitism. He also makes a very clear statement that where once upon a time anti-Semitism was hatred against the Jews, it is now hatred of the Jews against other people. As in, anti-Semitism was once defined by as people who hate the Jews, but now the definition of anti-Semitism is anyone that the Jews don't like. That's how Atzmon has it, and Atzmon, of course, is a proud, self-hating Jew who's, according to his own account, he's universally hated by Jews everywhere, no matter whether they're Zionists, whether they're Israelis, whether they're Judaism practitioners, there isn't a word for that one, etc. Like, even though there are all these different definitions of what being a Jew is, one thing they seem to be united on is hatred of this guy, Gilead. And I'm only halfway through the book, but so far I haven't found anything particularly offensive. Of course, it wouldn't be offensive to me, but I mean, there's nothing hateful in there, and there's nothing derogatory, and there's nothing insulting. He's simply trying to understand something, which is obviously very close to his own core and center as a self slash identity, as a consciousness, as a cultural creation, and so on. He's a Jew. He identifies as a Hebrew-speaking Palestinian, good for him, but anyway, he was born in Israel, and etc. So, this is an example of somebody who's trying to understand something about himself, and it has ramifications culturally, socially, politically, etc. And so he's become persona non grata, as I expect to write about in the next Substack. I knew about The Wandering Hebrew, but I was only inspired to actually order and read it. It's from Zero Books, who published Seen and Not Seen in 2015. When Luke Dodson pointed out that there'd been an open letter by some Zero Books authors denouncing this book and saying that it should be suppressed. And among those names on this open letter, it was Nina Power, with whom I did an event in London last year, and who I consider an ally and perhaps a friend, although that's not a word I use very freely. But we get along, and we seem to see eye to eye, and I think we've collaborated well together, and I like her a lot. Anyway, I did contact her about it and say, well, what's up there, and she admitted that she had only signed that letter because her boyfriend at the time had signed it, and inferred that she regretted it, but she didn't say anything about the book, or I presume Nina's is a discerning woman, and I presume that she must have read the book to have signed that letter denouncing it, and my mind boggles, really, because it's an excellent book, and I think that anybody who's interested in the JQ needs to read it, and beyond that. I don't know who could not be interested in the Jewish question, but of course I recognise that not everybody is trying to understand what's going on in the world or our existence, and that there's only so much time if they are, They can't cover everything, so I'm not going to say that the JQ is absolutely fundamental to understanding human nature or existence, but certainly to understanding the world as it is and as it has been for the last 1,000 or 2,000 years, it's pretty essential, I'd say. But anyway, be that as it may or may not, it's an excellent book, and as I said, there's nothing hateful about it. I feel strange just saying that, but I mean, there's nothing. He's not being overly didactic. He's not particularly forceful. He's asking a lot of questions, but he is overturning a rock that I would say a whole temple has been built on top of to prevent from being overturned. And somehow he's able to just slip in there and flip it over. It turns out that perhaps what appeared to be a temple was not a temple at all, but was just a holographic illusion of a temple. Once you turn over that rock, my God, those are some very interesting bugs crawling around, and strangely familiar. His arguments, many of them anyway, I would say, have the quality that I most value in writing, especially my own, if I can achieve it, which is self-evidence. What Blake said, the truth can never be stated as to be understood and not to be believed. If the truth is stated well enough, then it is self-evident. It is clearly self-evident. It doesn't have to be argued. So his book is full of statements of this kind, I think. One can see or feel the general truth of, while then appreciating the application to the Jewish question and how they ring just as true there, and they make sense of it. I will give some examples in a minute, but I brought this up actually as an example itself of a broader question, which is, what is the price of speaking out? I've hesitated, I'm a bit stuck there, because the term self-expression is not one I particularly like. Speaking one's mind is not a good expression. Speaking one's truth is a terrible expression, in my opinion. But being honest, being open, being vulnerable, being willing to say whatever one feels the need to say about any question, any subject, no matter what, and irrespective of consequences. This is essential to living in the world, interacting with other human beings, being an individual as part of a collective. It is absolutely essential that we not be oppressed, restricted, confined by any kind of censorship that stems from either from the group itself or from our own fear, our own self-censoring mechanism that relates to the group, as in that we don't want to be cast out by the group and therefore we self-censor, or an individual, which is really always a group, always represents a group. Right? We might have very specific individuals who are particularly important to us, but that would have to do with transference, mother-father issues and so on, brother issues, but nonetheless, just as parents represent one's connection to the whole collective tribe and human tribe that one is part of, so individuals who are particularly important to us, their validation, their opinion, their judgment, and the possibility of their condemnation, they are so insofar as they seem to represent the whole group to us. Like to be accepted by that person or to be condemned by that person is equivalent to being accepted or condemned by the whole tribe. So as a basic principle, the reason that I was drawn to talk about the Holocaust and the Jew question, besides it being a burning subject that I thought was, if it wasn't addressed, might burn the whole house down, let's say, it had to be contained and channeled. If you have fire in your house, then roast some chicken on it, and put some bricks around it and use it as a source of heat and energy rather than just letting it run away and burn everything down. Make sure that a potential negative is a definite positive. That was my approach to the Holocaust and the Jewish question. It's there, it's burning, it needs to be addressed, etc. And that reality, I would say, or that point of view that I have, is inseparable from, if we can't talk about it, then we need to talk about it. We need to at least talk about why we can't talk about it. So anyway, so I've been talking about it, but I've also been talking about why it's so difficult to talk about it. And I will just say that some people have been upset by this, have been discombobulated, have been disturbed. But I don't want to go into the details because it would take too damn long and because it would involve people who are already upset with me for talking about it. So I would just be adding fuel to the fire, and although I don't care if it's necessary to me to talk about it, which is the whole point I'm making, nonetheless I don't want to do it wantonly or willy-nilly. And I am aware also, and this is a very key insight of the last week, is that it is very, very difficult for me, and I think for just about everyone, to stand my ground without pushing back against those forces or individuals or ideas even that are threatening to knock me off my ground, whether directly or indirectly. As in, they might just be ideas or opinions that I find threatening because they disagree, or they might be active attempts to get me to change my position, let's say. So it's important to me through this process of what I feel is an ongoing attempt to censor and to silence me, albeit at a very minor level, as I would be talking about the details and specifics. It's very important to me to be aware that there's something in me that wants to push back when that happens, but that's also a way to not stand one's ground, essentially, as in martial arts. So you've got to stay planted and just wait for the opposing force to come in and then redirect it or push against it in such a way that it strengthens one's footing, but never go out of one's own center in order to try and counteract that force. Resistance only makes it stronger. As soon as we lose our balance, then that's it. We're in the weaker position. So this is really very much an absolute central principle that I want to share here, which is stand your ground no matter what, but don't push back against what's threatening your ground, because then you also lose ground. It is enough to simply stand one's ground and not give an inch. But it's extremely hard. It's a kind of not doing. It's extremely hard not to counteract a force that is coming at one. One has to have absolute trust in one's own ability to be rooted in what one knows is true. So, with this Holocaust and this due question, it's an opportunity for me to practice this art, because I don't know what's true about the Jews and I don't know what's true about the Holocaust, but I do know what's true when it comes to censorship and silencing and oppression around these subjects. I do know that it is necessary for me and for anyone to be able to talk about these things freely and not to be censored and silenced and accused of hate crime or of anti-Semitism or of fueling the fires of something or insensitivity or anything else. I mean, one can be accused of those things, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if one is accused of those things, as long as I know that I'm simply trying to explore something by talking about it. That much I know. That much I know, that this is the right thing to be doing. And indeed, the more resistance there is, the more I know that it's worth doing. Because that's the reason I'm doing it, is to find out is it safe? And if it isn't safe, well, you carry on doing it. And you find out, okay, well, it wasn't safe, but I have to. It's like, you know, you want to, you know, you have to go a certain way. You don't know if the land you're crossing is a minefield, so you start crossing it. And if you find out it's a minefield, well, you have to keep on going. You just proceed with ever more caution and awareness and sensitivity, indeed. So what's the point here? The point is that well, I don't know actually what the point is. I think I've made the point, really. I was thinking of an analogy to make it clear, so it's not too vague and abstract. So imagine that, this is easy for me to imagine. Imagine that you discovered that there was abuse in your family history, and you even over time you figured out who was involved and so on. So you had some powerful burning questions, but you even had some half answers. So you started to write about it, let's say. And as you're writing about it, you reached out to family members, or at least one, let's say. Say it was your brother. And you talked to him, and he began to corroborate what you were saying. And he actually had useful information. So you checked in with him, and you said, well, you know, would you want to talk about this, and can I put it on record? And it will be anonymous. And so your brother agrees that you can talk to him and use what he says anonymously. Even though you were naming names and so on, and you knew there was some risk involved, but your brother agreed, and so you went ahead and you published something about it. And only after you published it, you found out that all this pressure was coming from your family, not to you, but to your brother. And your brother was under so much pressure that he caved, and he came to you and he said, I need you to take that stuff out, take it down, get rid of it, because I've been compromised. Basically, your brother panics because of this pressure, and he becomes afraid that what he's shared can be used against him in some way, that he's exposed himself to some form of attack or legal action. And so the pressure that he feels he's under, he then applies to you. And so the fear was a combination of actual legal, real-world consequences with a kind of anxiety of vulnerability. And, of course, that he was receiving all this disapproval from his family, which is also your family. So what do you do then? You're in the middle of a process of trying to expose the truth, trying to understand the truth, trying to explore this area that has been verboten. And somebody that you're collaborating with, they back out, they cave to a kind of pressure and a kind of anxiety that you feel is very central to the reasons that you're trying to uncover this in the first place. I invite you to consider this anyway as a thought experiment. Anyway, what I'm attempting to do here is to talk about something that's actually been happening in a way that's sufficiently abstract and metaphorical, so that I don't have to get into the specific details. And the moral of the story is simply this, is that there will always be social pressure, personal pressure, family pressure, peer pressure, every imaginable kind of pressure coming from outside of one. And any weak points that one has, any kind of areas of loyalty or of investment that one has to the world, which includes other human beings, social creatures, I mean, not necessarily souls. Because this is the question, I mean, this is the moral, really, is that what does my soul want? What does my brother's soul want? If I trust in my felt sense, which is really a kind of certainty, that the soul, above all, wants the end of secrecy, wants complete openness, and honesty, and a lack of concealment, complete transparency. If I trust in that, then I have to trust that whatever the consequences are at a social level, it is the right thing to do, which is why I was willing to write and talk about the Holocaust in the end, even though I was aware that I could be punished for it, I might be punished for it in the future. But because this whole ongoing attempt to censor and control and suppress the life force and our awareness about what's happening, what's real, has encroached so far that we don't know any longer what we can get away with saying anyway. So then it becomes futile to try and act strategically, over strategically anyway, I'm not against strategy, to protect oneself from censure, from consequences, from punishment, for saying the wrong thing, at whatever level, whether it's at the social level, at the family level, or whether it's at the worldly level of actual legal consequences, and jail time and so on. As I end on a personal note, which is this is the human organism who was named Jason Horsley about 57 years ago, doing a cognitive dissonant podcast, maybe, at the Children of Job, at Substack, where I write regular think pieces and do these podcasts, usually with somebody else. I encourage anyone who does find out about me to subscribe and to, if you're really curious, to go all the way into this temporary autonomous zone, to pay to subscribe and to share and to like and to spread around whatever it is that you find here that has meaning.
When you find yourself idle or stagnant, it's important that you move from place to place. But if your knees start buckling, your stomach starts rustling, your ankles all swell, hell, I've been like that too, man. And here's what I do. Yeah.